People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast in which two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. On this episode, in the red corner, a serial killer with a penchant for putting tights on the top half of his face is on the loose, and only one man can stop him from Michael Mann. It's 1986's Manhunter.
Multiple trails.
Just you and me now, sport.
One hunter. Manhunter.
While in the blue corner, have the lambs stopped screaming, Clarice? Well, answer that question and others, because crack open the Chianti. It's 1991's Silence of the Lambs.
A killer is on the loose. A rookie FBI agent is on his trail. But in order to track him down, she'll have to match wits.
I'll help you catch him, Clary.
With the darkest of all minds.
So what connects these two movies, and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Clash Podders, I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And this week, as you just heard, we are doing Silence of the Lambs up against Manhunter. V, you pick these movies.
Hooray! Yeah. Yes, I pick these two films. I pick Silence of the Lambs because it gives me the chance to talk about my two favourite things, which is murders and breastfeeding. Not really. Murders and feminism.
Right.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
Also, I'm terrified of moths, which I think you know. Terrified.
Actually, that's new information to me. What?
Yeah, like to the point where my brain scrambles and I get like that metallic fear taste in my mouth and a weight on my chest and I can't form a rational thought. So I love Clarice Starling because she's a brave bitch.
Where does that fear come from?
Well, I've thought about it for this. I think it comes from The Silence of the Lambs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Before that, you were almost called the moth girl. Like you used to sort of wander around with a troupe of performing moths.
Yeah, and I loved moths. I let them crawl all over my face.
Yeah, yeah. You'd often be found lying in a park surrounded by light bulbs and moths
and
at night.
And then after this, I just couldn't. I can't. Some of the scenes inside of the Lambs, I can't watch because of the moths. Mm. I just can't.
That's the power of cinema right there.
It really is. Manhunter, I saw it about 15 years ago, but it didn't make much of an impact on me, so I wanted to go back and see it again, and I did feel very differently about it this time.
Good, that's where I am.
Turns out I love a troubled man.
Welcome to the party.
Is that why you're doing a podcast with me and Alex?
So genuinely, my history is, I watched Silence of the Lambs years and years ago, loved it, and I remember having seen that, going back to watch Manhunter, and I got to the first scene of Hannibal Lecter, played by Brian Cox, and turned it off. I literally couldn't handle the fact that it wasn't Anthony Hopkins playing that role. The movie lost me in one moment. So actually, I'd only seen to that point, so this was a first viewing for me.
Wow, that's interesting. Mm. Yeah, I guess my history is I was weirdly young when I got into serial killers. And I think it was off the back of Manhunter. I was trying to figure out the timeline because Manhunter was made in 86. But I read about it in Empire magazine and then immediately read Red Dragon. And that would have made me 8 years old when I read Red Dragon, which can't be possible. But then I think it didn't come out in England for 3 years. It didn't come out till 1989 in England. Okay. By that point, I was 11, probably 12 by the time it came out on video. So that was when I read Red Dragon, which is a bit less weird.
Okay.
So I read Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. I figured out the date I saw Manhunter.
Okay, go on.
August 10th, 1991, because it was on Moviedrome. Do you remember Moviedrome with Alex Cox presenting films on a Saturday night?
Yeah, do you know why I love that so much? Two of the greatest movies back to back I watched on that, still to date, my favourite double bill of films ever, Alligator and Cue the Winged Serpent. It was incredible.
Could that be coming up on a future show?
It is now. I've just made that executive decision, like Kurt Russell in the movie, executive decision.
That's a great double bill. Did you see the films? Have you read the books?
I've read Silence of the Lambs, mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about you? Have you done the books?
Nope.
Okay. I've read the books, but not for a long time. Yeah. So I was trying to piece together interesting stuff they left out and what they kept in.
Oh, well, that's a good idea. Mm. Well done.
I'm even more excited about the journey we're going on together. All right then. So Manhunter was released, as Chris just said, in 1989 in the UK, but it was released first, which means we start with Manhunter. V, you gave that to Chris. Chris, take us away.
In this unconventional romance, boy meets girl, boy encourages girl to stroke sleeping tiger, boy makes love to girl, boy tries to kill girl with bits of broken mirror. Then finally, boy gets shot in chest.
Intruder entered through kitchen sliding door.
Nationwide victims.
Yeah, this is Will Graham of the FBI.
One killer.
This is what the subject's teeth look like.
Manhunter.
Yeah, Manhunter.
Yay! AKA Red Dragon.
Yeah. Dino De Laurentiis changed its name from Red Dragon because Michael Cimino, he'd released a movie called The Year of the Dragon that year, and it had flopped, and so they wanted to distance himself from it. So they called it Manhunter, a name that I don't believe Michael Mann was a huge fan of.
No, on the commentary, he says that it was because he was worried people would think it was Hong Kong Chop Socky, is what he called it.
Right.
And he didn't really like it, and Brian Cox thinks it's terrible.
Yeah.
He says it's cheesy, and it should have been a Red Dragon. But actually, when you think about what they did in the film, they really pulled back on the dragon stuff.
Mm.
So we're talking about a serial killer, Francis Dolarhyde, who believes he's turning into a dragon, a godlike dragon.
Mm.
And he has it in the book. He has a tattoo all over his body of a dragon. In the film, they shot scenes with him with that tattoo. And Michael Mann said he thought it looked silly and trivialised his issues and therefore reshot all those scenes without the tattoo. So I think you lose a lot from the book just by pulling back on that. So yeah, the plot sort of in a nutshell is Francis Dolarhyde is a serial killer who breaks into homes and murders families.
He's based on a real person. Do you want to know who he's based on?
Hmm.
You don't.
Yeah,
do
I have
you?
Questions. Oh. No, I have questions about this because...
Why?
Go ahead.
Did you do the killing?
No.
He's based on, well, he's supposed to be based on Dennis Rader, who was called the BTK person, because he's called the BTK for bind, torture, kill, and he's like your real life worst nightmare. He would hide in people's houses and wait for them to come home and then
kill. Isn't he the guy who's in Mindhunter? You know the show Mindhunter? At the start of every episode, it shows him going about his business. Have you not watched Mindhunter?
I haven't watched Mindhunter.
Yes. How are you into all this and you haven't watched Mindhunter?
Because I've got a limit as to how much of it I can... Yeah, do you want to know how the BTK killer was caught? Because it is quite a funny story, actually.
I'm up for it.
So he wasn't caught at the time. So apparently at the time that Red Dragon was being written, BTK was like on the loose. So that's in the 80s. And then in 2004, as a cold case, the police like reached out to the killer through the newspapers. And someone got in touch to say to the police, you know floppy disks, can you get any information off floppy disks like about the person that's made them? And they were like, no. So we went, oh, okay, I'll send you a floppy disk. And they went, ha-ha, lying. And then they found out that a person called Dennis had made the floppy disk. There was a connection to the Lutheran church. So they Googled Dennis, the area where they lived, the church, and then they found him. And that was it. He was caught.
It's about time the internet gave something back.
That's the thing. And then he was caught.
So if that is who Francis Dolarhyde is based on, once Michael Mann got hold of it, there was a killer that he'd met called Dennis Wayne Wallace.
Yeah.
And he wanted to make a film about him. And so that's why we've got a kind of an amalgamation of the characters, and it's not really true to the book.
Mm.
I couldn't find much information about this Dennis Wayne Wallace on the internet.
Do you know when I stopped? When you couldn't click on his name on Wikipedia. I was like, that's the level of research I'm doing.
Doesn't exist.
So all my information comes from Michael Mann talking about him on the commentary. He was a strange man, this killer.
Shit. As opposed to the nice, normal serial killer.
He used to wear a hat that said, support mental illness or I'll kill you. He had a tattoo of Dennis the Menace on his arm, and he drove around in a hearse.
I know some people with some bad tattoos, including me.
Now, I have a question. Is he the same guy who Michael Mann spoke to, and part of the conversation was that he was obsessed with a woman who he didn't know, and he believed that a song was their song, and that song was Iron Butterflies in A Gadda Da Vida, and that's why that is in the film.
Yeah, she was part of a biker gang, I think, and he saw her like for 45 minutes and believed that they were meant to be together, and the people he murdered were members of this biker gang, according to Michael Mann, but I don't know. I can't find this guy online. So the FBI is having trouble tracking down this serial killer who they've nicknamed the Tooth Fairy.
He doesn't like that.
He's not a fan.
He's not a fan of that. But I have sympathy
because he's the Red Bloody Dragon.
Right. Yeah. If you go to all the effort to go, I want to be known as the Red Dragon, and someone goes, yeah, you're the Tooth Fairy. It's like the Reservoir Dogs thing. No one wants to be Mr. Pink.
Yeah. So they're having trouble tracking him down. So at the start of the film, Jack Crawford from the FBI goes and meets Will Graham. And is he a detective?
Who? The guy, Jack Crawford?
Will Graham.
No, Will Graham's a criminal profiler.
Criminal profiler. And he has quit the force because of what happened when he caught Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. What's unusual is normally when you have that cop brought back in for one last case, normally they're a drunk, holed up in a house like with no family or anything like that. You think Bruce Willis in Die Hard with a Vengeance, and they're like, sober up, come on, we need you. And in this, he's like loving it. He's having a great time building fences to protect turtle hatchlings.
Oh, I love the symbolism. I just thought it was, oh, beautiful. He's got such a fantastic house. I'm so jealous of that house.
So what does his wife do we think? Because a criminal profiler does not get a house on a beach like that.
And neither of them seem to work anymore, do they?
No.
No.
They make love in blue brooms.
They do, beautifully.
The most 80s sex scene I think I've seen for a long time.
I was transfixed. Yeah. I was so jealous.
I really like Molly, the character of Molly. She's very tolerant.
She's very tolerant, but also a little bit naive at some points, I think.
She's in a lot more scenes in the director's cut. Did you guys see the director's cut? That was a question I was going to ask, actually, because there's a bunch of versions of this film, and it seems like a few of them have now been taken out of circulation, and you can only see this one version.
I bought a DVD with a special book in it.
Ooh.
Yeah, nice. I was going to bring it for you. Actually. I don't think I have. It's really good, the book.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's called Michael Mann's Head Games. It's cool.
Do we have...
look at his face. He's
look,
like,
he's really
there's
excited.
Something I don't have or know
oh,
about.
Shit. Do you not know about... Oh, brilliant.
Do we have
Let's
exciting
talk about
info from the book?
My research this week. You just, honestly, take a day off. You'll be fine.
So do you think you guys saw the director's cut?
How would I know? How would I know?
So, well, my
has
Blu-ray,
it got a massively different ending? Yeah.
No, it's just got lots of scenes all the way through. He says it's his preferred version with the benefit of hindsight. So it's not scenes that he was made to take out, but having sort of given it a few years, he wanted to put these scenes back in.
Yeah, because he had free rein on the final cut.
Yeah.
Like there was no pressure on him. So
100%.
He just chose to go back and re-edit it.
They don't bring a lot to... There's one scene, actually, at the end that does change things a little bit, but we'll talk about that when we get to it.
So Will Graham, I went, oh, I've heard that name before, and that's because I actually watched the Hannibal TV show. Have you ever watched the Hannibal TV show? It's the only TV show I've ever turned off because it scared me too much.
It's very frightening.
It's really good. Have you seen it, though?
I have seen the whole thing,
So I stopped after the episode where there's something under the bed and the woman gets dragged under the bed and it's that weird woman.
Yeah.
And then like she just gets grabbed by the feet and then an arc of blood just sprays out from under the bed. And I was like, fuck this shit. I'm going home.
But did the show not make you hungry, though? You haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it, but so I understand the content.
They would have long sequences of him cooking lovely food, but there'd be human ingredients in there.
Sure.
But they made it look tasty. Based on the films, his cannibalism seems to be sort of biting cheeks off and things like that and faces off rather than having a nice
dinner.
Cordon bleu dinner. So the reason they brought Will Graham in is because he's extremely sensitive and he can put himself in the shoes of the killer. He can imagine their fantasies and figure out their motives and even try and predict their plans. Some of which seems a bit out there, I think, the idea that he can sort of see their dreams.
I think you just don't see proof of it in him. That's one of its problems. Like you're supposed to be seeing a man on the edge between, it's like his ability has driven him to this to madness before, but you don't ever see any of that.
I will say this. I didn't really know Kevin Peterson. Didn't know who he was. Not really seen him in anything.
What about his brother, William Peterson?
Yeah. Is that his name?
He's not the cricketer.
Oh, right.
The actor.
That's why when I Googled him, I was like, oh, he's had a great career after movies. He's a movie star and a world-class cricket player.
He lost the South African accent.
Yeah, William Peterson.
Yeah.
So I didn't really know him because I never watched CSI because he was the main guy on CSI for like a decade.
Gil Grissom. Yeah, I went through a period of watching all the CSIs in about 3 months when I first got Netflix and you sent off for the discs. That was the first time I ever binge watched anything. And it is very similar. You can see that this inspired the police procedurals we see now. It's so similar. And to be honest, even his character is quite similar. Literally, I think Danny Cannon just saw what he did in this film and just transplanted it here.
I know that it's not one of the performances in the movie that's regarded as like shit hot. I think he's brilliant.
I think he's really good.
Really, really liked his performance in this. And again, we were talking about The Fog recently and how one of the best scenes in that is a person reading. In this,
yeah.
When he's reading through the police notes and he's walked into the crime scene, first yeah. of all, now that's a crime scene. That's an incredible crime scene. But him reading those notes, I was like, oh, this is so dark. The bit where he's talking about how the father had his throat cut.
Because he went after the children.
Yeah, oh. he was like, what does he say? He says something like, bloodstains on the wall suggest arterial spray. Even with his throat cut, he tried to fight because the killer was heading to the children's room.
Oh, that's bad.
It makes you visualise it.
He's got a good thinking face as well. You feel like the cogs are turning when he's thinking.
Yeah.
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 Agreed. Absolutely. Cogs turning. Mm-hmm. Thinking.
He does have a very beautiful thinking face, but I just didn't get that next level of like, I'm very much tortured by these thoughts and willingly so on.
Can we talk about Dennis Farina as well?
So, of course yeah. we can.
He's brilliant. I spent a long time in this movie going, where is he from? Where do I know him from? Snatch is where I know
yeah.
him from.
Get
as
Shorty.
Avi.
Yeah.
Snatch, Get Shorty. He always seems to play characters at the end of their tether. That's what he's good at.
Yeah. He's great in Snatch, where he arrives back in the US and they go, anything to declare? And he goes, yeah, don't go to England.
and the other, probably the other actor we should talk about before we get to the big one is Stephen Lang.
Yes! I love Stephen Lang.
Best known for being big and buff in Avatar.
Yeah. I first saw him as the party crasher in The Hard Way, the Michael J. Fox, James right. Woods buddy cop comedy.
So he plays a sleazy tabloid journalist and you buy him as that, don't
He's
you?
He's having the time of his life.
He is a full-on creep. But they sort of come up with a plan together to bait the Tooth Fairy. Mm.
It's a truly horrifying scene where he captures Stephen Lang and he's got him in his room and the Tooth Fairy standing there with some skin-coloured tights over the top half of his face. And Stephen Lang is like, no, must look away, tights.
Well, that's the first time you see Francis Dolarhyde, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Tom Noonan playing Francis Dolarhyde.
Are the tights a fetish thing, though, or is it that he genuinely thinks he would be unrecognisable? I assumed it was a fetish thing, so it's like, you still look just exactly
well,
like
him. Well, he knows he's going to kill him, so...
Because yeah. he's on fire, pushed down a ramp in a multi-storey car park. Those places are scary at the best of times.
They are.
And when you're on fire, strapped into a wheelchair, having had your face slashed open, they're even scarier.
Well, bitten open. That's the worst.
Well, I think... I don't know if you got this from the film, but what I vaguely remember from the book is he bites his lips off.
No.
Did you get that?
No.
But also, I thought I'd seen that in the film and it cut away. Maybe I'm getting confused with Red Dragon, but it definitely cuts away. You hear the screams and it cuts away, which I think it does quite a lot in both these films today. A lot of cutaways of things I thought I'd seen.
Oh, what, the age old, like, oh yeah, you see Gwyneth Paltrow's head in the box in Seven and you never do, but people are so...
Yeah.
See, exactly, yeah. You never see her head in the box, but because it's such a powerful like moment, you do believe you've seen her head in a box.
Has it been spoofed with a... I'm sure... Because I remember even thinking, that looks like a wax head in a box.
You're thinking of the Lonely Island video, Dick in a Box.
Sorry. God, I am as well. No, I'm not.
It was Justin Timberlake. I put my dick in a box.
What the fuck?
No, go on. Well, I'll show you it in the pub afterwards. It's great.
Great.
It's really good.
Yeah.
So when we meet Francis Dolarhyde, he sort of, during the film, he's slightly... softens potentially because he meets a woman at his work, Reba, played by Joan Allen, who he seems to or believes that he's falling in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
She is a blind woman, so she can't see his facial disfigurement. This is where part of his issues have come from, is by thinking that women hate the way he looks and therefore he hates the way he looks.
Yeah, I will say, she surprised me with some of her decision making.
Sure.
When he goes... ride with me.
Yeah.
And she goes, no.
Nope.
He goes, ride with me. And she goes, oh, no, I'm fine. I'm going to get the bus. He goes, ride with me because I want you to.
That
she goes,
to do the trick.
Yeah, she's like, yeah, all right. Why not?
To add to that, he's like, let me take you somewhere. And the answer is, absolutely fucking not. Yeah. Take me home or leave me alone. But she's like, yeah, sure, we'll go for a surprise trip. No big deal.
Where does he take her though, Vicky?
I don't know how it happens, but he takes her to a... large animal veterinary surgery of some sort, where a tiger is going to have a dental procedure and the tiger is therefore asleep. And I was moved by it. I do think it's a really like rich moment, and she's never seen a tiger because she's blind. so she can see with her hands, and so she gets to cuddle a tiger.
Yeah. So that's a good first date.
I would say so.
Yeah, okay. It goes downhill from there.
Well, not immediately.
Yeah, and how do you top that, though, for the second date? I mean, I guess he tried to kill her pretty much on the second date.
Put mirrors in her eyes.
But tiger is such a high bar to set for yourself.
Yeah.
But he's a monster. He believes himself to be a monster and falls in love with a blind woman. Isn't that the Fantastic Four?
Wait, what?
The thing falls in love with a blind woman.
Oh, yes! Yeah. Michael Chiklis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I forgot about that.
Well, not Chiklis in this instance.
Good one!
There we are.
I like that.
That was good. That was strong.
That's right. Yeah. You laugh.
I was sort of more... It was more admiration over my face.
And admiring silence.
I realise on a podcast no one can see me go, oh. Yeah. So next time I'll laugh. All right, let's get on to the big one. So Will Graham, as part of his investigation, it's decided that he'll go and meet with Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
Cool.
The man who tried to kill him and sent him over the edge.
Mm.
He is played by Brian Cox.
Brilliant. Mm. Absolutely brilliant and scarier. Yeah. Far, far scarier than Anthony Hopkins' version.
Do you know who he based his performance on, Brian Cox?
I've seen a couple of things.
The thing I read in Head Games... Mm. That Chris hasn't read,
yes.
is that Brian Cox based his portrayal of Hannibal Lecter on his own son. You know, imagine that.
Oh my God.
So his son was about 15 at the time, and Michael Mann said to him, the reason I've hired you as a British actor is you need to bring a sense of like imperiousness to this role. So Hannibal Lecter takes his ego with him wherever he is. So when the prison warden brings him the phone, he says, thank you very much, I'll tell you when I'm done. And so he's reversing their situation in that he's being served, even though he's in prison. And he thought, Brian Cox said, you know, he was raised in Dundee, I think, like quite a rough life. But obviously by the time he had kids, he was doing very well. So his son went to a British private school. So he channeled his son's attitude to bring to the part of Hannibal Lecter of like treating people with disdain. Yeah.
Basically. That's what his son learned at British private school.
Well, obviously.
Right, okay, yeah. You're failing to make a very exciting connection here.
Oh, what is it?
You've talked about his son before on this podcast.
Oh, wait, that's... No, I forgot.
Alex Cox is his name.
Oh, a thingy! In the Sherlock thing.
Yeah, he's Watson in Sherlock Holmes.
Oh my God!
So Hannibal Lecter is based on that kid because it's also, that was the year before. So he would have been around that age.
Oh my God.
That's amazing.
Well, I wasn't even on that episode and I figured that out.
I'm glad
you do a lot of legwork, to be fair to you.
Glad I didn't know that when I was watching young Sherlock Holmes.
No.
That would have ruined it. He's kind of northern though in this, isn't he? His Hannibal Lecter. There's a northern
twang. A little bit, yeah.
He keeps sort of, I couldn't really place his accent. Yeah, there was a moment
I feel like it's a Scottish man doing a slightly posh English accent.
No, because when he asks for the file, he's like, let me have file and I'll tell.
He does not. You did this last week, your impression.
He does. He was like, let me have file. I'll tell thee when I'm done.
That's not an impression. That's what he really sounds like.
Yeah. Do you dream much, Will? Do you?
Yeah. What did you think of him as Hannibal Lecter?
I'm only able to do it in comparison to Anthony Hopkins. And Brian Cox himself said, although I believe this quote is true because I read it in Head Games that you haven't read. Brian Cox said, I haven't seen Tony's version, but I believe it's very, very over the top. And it's like, of course you've seen it. And that's just such a mean thing to say. So I can only do it.
Sorry, Brian Cox said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, really? I haven't seen Tony's version. I believe it's very, very over the top.
The interviews I've seen with him, all he said, he hasn't said anything negative. All he said, I would have liked the money that Anthony Hopkins got for doing this.
But then apparently he was offered the part in Silence of the Lambs and he turned it down because he says he didn't do sequels. So
I don't think that. I've never heard that. Is that true?
I read it in
Head Games. Head Games. The book that exists, but Vicky forgot to bring today. This is all made up. This is all bullshit.
It's a free book as well.
So Brian Dennehy, who I spoke to you about. You know that guy now.
So
The main guy in Cocoon.
The main guy in Cocoon who pulls down his eyelid.
Exactly.
And,
He really desperately wanted the role of Hannibal Lecter and is good friends with Michael Mann.
Mm.
And but being such a good friend, he said to him, actually, there's this other actor you should see who I think will be better than me. What a nice chap.
That's a lovely
thing. That was Brian Cox.
Yeah, and he looks after his race of aliens really well.
I like the fact that you see Brian Cox in his socks at some point during the film. I just thought that I did another layer.
Do you know what? Did you ever see like the Cameron Crowe movie Elizabethtown?
I have seen it,
okay,
yes.
You remember the bit where Kirsten Dunst and Orlando Bloom have that really long phone conversation for ages. The way that Will Graham and Helen Valector talk to each other, it's like one's in an armchair with his legs slung over the side, the other's got his feet up against the wall. I'm like, it's like a late night booty call.
Well, it really is. They look like a couple.
Yep.
Or at least friends.
And that was on purpose. And a man says that he loves doing, he said other directors don't like doing scenes where the actors aren't in the same place. He said, I love it because they can be doing whatever they want to be doing at the other end of the phone. So you can have real fun with their physicality and their expressions and things, which you can't when they're in the same space.
Mm. Apparently, Tom Noonan, who plays Francis Dolarhyde, obviously, he refused to meet any of the other cast because he wanted to create this air of terror about him. And he walked around the set spying on them and being a real creep. And no one got to meet him. Will Graham didn't meet him until he crashes through the window at the end, which is also the worst plan ever.
It's so badly thought out, and he crashes through this window and then he immediately gets floored. It's like, what did you think would happen?
It's like, and it's a massive glass window.
Yeah.
So like literally the Tooth Fairy can see him coming for ages.
that felt like the most, because obviously Michael Mann created Miami Vice. That felt like the most Miami Vice moment in the film, him jumping through the window and that weird staccato like way that they film the shootout, which is all cameras running at different speeds, which I don't know. I think when I first watched it, I was having to check the tracking on my video because it does look very odd.
Yeah, I didn't like the shootout, and apparently it was rushed as well because he'd run out of time because he's so meticulous. He'd used up all his time and most of the crew had left at that point, so he had a skeleton crew to work with, which is why it's the worst part of the film for me.
Hmm. But it's all to that. So it's quite effective being played out to that song that you mentioned earlier.
So we need to talk about the music in this, because half this movie I genuinely feel is ruined by the soundtrack, and the other half it's the most wonderful soundtrack ever.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. It's just so 80s that it's distracting.
Well, when it I feel like when it sounds like Blade Runner, I love it, and then when it's quite intrusive pop songs, I feel like this is true because I've seen it so many times now. I feel like some of the dialogue isn't recorded terribly well, and I was finding it hard to hear what they're saying. Mm. I just feel like the music is too loud sometimes.
Mm. Yeah. There's a scene on a plane in this movie.
Oh, yeah, that's a good scene.
Where Will Graham falls asleep and his briefcase falls open. And
it doesn't fall open.
It does, because all the pictures of the murders are...
Oh, God, you know what I thought that was? I thought that was the only time that we saw for ourselves that he is the same as Hannibal Lecter, in that he didn't regard the content of the pictures to be that serious. So he falls asleep without thinking, I should cover those up because there's a little girl next to me.
No, so they're spread on the table.
No. They're not spread on the table. He's, because you see him pin two pictures of the families up that aren't in any way grotesque.
Oh, really?
And then he's fallen asleep and then he wakes up to the child screaming because his briefcase has fallen open.
Well, that's annoying, because I was like, Michael Mann, like, if you're listening, which you definitely are, that my idea is so much better.
No, but I had a question for you, because obviously, like, the mother of the kid is like, oh my God, get her out of
mental.
You have kids, but you also love murder.
I do.
How would you react in that situation if that was your kid?
Swap seats with the kid?
Stop whining for one goddamn minute.
Don't spook him. He's my new favourite person on this plane.
Stop spilling my gin. What is wrong with you?
So, can I get some of those pictures? Do you need all of them?
Yeah, what are you working on?
That's a good one. And by good, I mean useful in your job.
Yeah, all of that one.
Yeah.
Would you like to know some things that aren't in the film?
There's no spaceship battle. There's not a dragon. No, there is a dragon. Yeah, there is actually a dragon. That was what a rubbish one to pick second. No, I literally did I did myself in.
But that helps me, speaking of a dragon. So in the book Red Dragon, Francis Dolarhyde is so obsessed with this William Blake painting, The Great Red Dragon and the Woman Clothed in Sun, and that's where all of this comes from, his obsession with that painting. He breaks into the Brooklyn Museum and eats the painting.
Oh, yes. I remember reading about
that. That would have been a hell of a scene in the movie.
It? Expensive, though, I feel.
But the one big change that I think is to the detriment of this film is that Hannibal Lecter tells Francis Dolarhyde where Will Graham's family is living.
Yeah.
And his family are taken to safety.
Yeah.
Now, in the book, Francis Dolarhyde fakes his own death at the end, this sequence at the end. He doesn't actually die. Fakes it, makes his way to Will Graham's house and attacks the family, cuts Will Graham in the face, so he ends up with the same injuries, but it's from the fight that they have. And Molly, the wife, shoots him dead.
Cool.
Which, it's weird the way that Hannibal Lecter just disappears from this movie, having been built up, having had two or three really memorable scenes. There's no real payoff or end to his story.
Didn't Michael Mann, wasn't it his point that he wanted to leave people wanting more? He actually resisted the urge to put more Hannibal Lecter in.
I 100% agree with that, but I think you also need closure as well. The character's just kind of... that phone call's the last conversation he has with him, and it doesn't really go anywhere. So I felt like that was a mistake.
In the book, is there any clarity to the following question which I have for you? So when he's torturing Stephen Lang and you meet Francis Dolarhyde, the Tooth Fairy, for the first time, is that shirt he's wearing covered in giant teeth? Because it looks like it is in the movie, and I was wondering if he'd sort of finally accepted the idea of being the Tooth Fairy and had made a costume.
What he I mean, he's just put in some big fake teeth as well, hasn't he?
Yeah.
I think he's against the name rather than the concept.
Right, okay. Well, that's fine then. I just thought it was a really, really cool shirt, and I was like, giant teeth, nice touch, Michael Mann.
Other weird bits of trivia?
Will Graham said that after the role to distance himself... William Peterson, Kevin Peterson's brother. he said to distance himself from the role of Will Graham, he bleached his hair and he shaved off his beard. I'd say calling that a beard is optimistic.
That's fair.
That is not a beard. This is a bit of stubble.
All right.
Yep, my trivia. Yeah, different to yours, sort of different tonally, but still counts as trivia. There are no wrong answers. Our new motto.
This is a weird one. Apparently, Brian Cox, in that final phone call, he wanted to sing a song that was at number one at the time.
I know this because I read it.
Go on.
Where did you read it?
Head Games.
I love that book, by the way.
If I find out you've actually read it, I'm going to punch you in the face. It's I Just Called to Say I Love You.
Yeah. And Michael Mann agreed with him, and they tried to get the rights to it so he could sing that down the phone to Will Graham.
That's a brilliant idea.
Really?
No.
I feel like that would have taken me right out of the film.
No, it would have been done with aplomb.
So in the supermarket, when him and his son have a real heart-to-heart...
I think that's a great scene. That's he talks about what Hannibal Lecter...
No, worst scene.
Oh.
Worst... scene.
But in the scene, it's when he's telling...
Any more than that, or it's just the worst scene?
You say what you want to say.
I was just saying, it's where we get this true insight into Lecter, where we find out how much and how badly
Who
he's affected
it?
Him.
Who gives one? Sure don't tell, first of all. Mm-hmm. Second of all, there's some continuity issues, but that's nitpicking.
Just to elaborate on that point further, would you like to know some of the cereals that are behind them in that scene?
Definitely.
There was Trix, Bran Muffin Crisp, Special K, Lucky Charms, Cheerios, and my favourite, Count Chocula.
Count Chocula.
So would they have had to get permission to use those cereals in the background? And if so, what cereal company is going to give permission to be used in Manhunter?
What a fascinating question.
Well, there's a whole chapter on that in Head Games.
Do you know who played Will Graham's son?
Oh, he looks so familiar. But no, tell me.
Yes, yeah. I was going to bring this up because I'm like, oh, here's something for Chris and his football. Played by David Seaman.
David Seaman, who was playing in goal for Birmingham and QPR that same year. So I think that's remarkable.
What's going on?
Right.
David Seaman plays his son.
Yeah. There's a
famous... But not the goalkeeper.
We don't know. I don't know. He looks different, but they could do stuff with makeup. That's before he had the moustache.
Get Head Games out. Check the index.
Yeah, they will.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
Inagada Davida. Inagada Davida. Do you know, Boney M covered it in 1980.
Okay.
Do you know what's unusual about that cover that they did? None of the original members of Boney M sung on it due to infighting.
Chris. Jesus Christ.
No wrong answers this week. There's no bad trivia, there's just trivia.
Hey, that plane scene that I was talking about, does no one want to do the trivia about how the fact that they couldn't get...
I don't, because I don't believe it.
Do you not believe it?
No, I don't. I just think he sounds like one of those fables. I don't believe it's true.
So the story is that they couldn't afford to hire a plane or build a plane fuselage, so they got on a flight from, I don't know, Florida to Chicago or something, and they took all the camera equipment with them, and that was a regular passenger plane, they just started filming on it. And
like guerrilla style.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't believe it is because when I saw the sunset through the window, I was like, that looks so fake.
Well, according to the book I read, Head Games, the pilot and stewardesses got super annoyed with them, and they had to sort of placate them by giving them
crew jackets.
Well, you might have seen the director's cut. You can tell because all the scenes are really bad quality that have been put back in.
Oh!
Yeah.
Yes, I saw the director's cut then, when sometimes the audio drops.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Okay.
Really no noticeable. The scene at the end where Will Graham, after it's all sort of calmed down, he's got cuts on his face, but they've healed up. So it's obviously a few weeks later, and he goes to a house of a family.
The family?
The family who were going to be killed by Francis Dolarhyde, but that wasn't in the original film. And I think that's a quite a powerful scene. Was that scene in your version?
It was not.
Oh!
Interesting.
Oh.
So I think the version you saw, you can't even get now. Didn't you get it on eBay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that's in circulation now, that one. It's only the director's cut is available now.
I will sell it to you for £5.
Did your version have the creepy scene where the woman has mirrored eyes?
Yeah.
That's creepy. I see myself reflected in the mirrors of your eyes. Mm.
But also, a little bit like Total Eclipse of the Heart video with Bonnie Tyler.
Fucking love that. Fucking love that.
But that's a bit scary.
Yeah, it is.
It also reminded me of the previous Michael Mann film, The Keep, where the monster in that has kind of shimmering eyes, I think, at some point. Have you seen The Keep?
No.
Oh my God, it's so good.
I'll watch it.
It's good. Fun.
It is. It's a really weird, weird movie, but it's good.
His 80s output is different to his... what he's done in recent years. So is this good Michael Mann or bad Michael Mann?
I think this film is brilliant. Mm. Like, I was so surprised. When I watched it, I've only seen it once before, and I was just like, oh, I don't, you know, whatever. It just washed over me, did not register at all. And then watching it in the week, I thought it was just so good and like a true rival to Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, I was so surprised. I had exactly the same experience. I put it on going, I've tried this before and it didn't go well, Manhunter, so this is on you.
Yeah.
And about 60 minutes in, I just paused it and I realised that my head hurt because I'd been frowning watching it so intensely.
Wow. Is it your favourite Michael Mann? What's your favourite Michael Mann movie?
Probably this or The Keep.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Vicky, what's your favourite Michael Mann movie?
Oh, it's this. I like Collateral. I do really like Collateral. Yeah.
Good choice.
Thanks.
What's yours, Chris?
You're both wrong. It's Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, it's a great film.
I love that. And everyone always says his films are a bit too cold, whereas I think that's the opposite. That's a really warm, romantic, beautiful movie.
Yeah.
Right, shall we get through to our categories?
So, Chris, what would you say your best scene is?
Freddie Lowndes' burning body coming tearing through the car park. I just think that's a really unexpected, dramatic, shocking moment. Mm.
And helped by the fact the security guard just before then goes, yeah.
He sells the shit out of it.
It really does.
But it's such a horrific image.
Mm.
What about you?
My best scene is when he first walks into the crime scene and starts reading through the notes.
See, that's my best scene is that scene, but you know what it's done at the end of the film. So he's walking back through the house and he's talking in, I think he's talking in the first person. No, he is talking in the first person. Most valuable character, Alex.
Tom Noonan as Francis Dolarhyde. I think his relationship with Reba, the most touching relationship in the whole film, is between the serial killer and his young female acquaintance that he makes.
His friend.
Yeah. And I also like the fact that he walked into the audition for the role and he was like, is it all right with you if I don't do any small talk and just read the lines?
Cool.
At that point, Michael Mann was like, I think
you're
we may
hired.
Have that guy.
What about you?
Well, this week, I feel like it's unfair in this category to say Hannibal Lecter in either of them. So I'm going to go with Alex. I think, yeah, Francis Dolarhyde, for the reasons Alex said, to be
my honest. Favourite character is the beach house. Love that place.
She's doing it on purpose now.
I knew that would piss you off.
You
can't hear me, but I'm making a face.
One change, Alex, that you would make to this film?
I would not have my lead actor, who I've been on this journey with, in such short shorts at the end.
I knew that would upset you.
I really did.
And also because they're pastel-coloured.
Pastel-coloured short shorts and very smooth legs.
Yeah, I thought that would upset you.
I paused my DVD because I was hoping that the chapter title would be Short Shorts and Smooth Legs. It's not.
Next summer, I'm totally wearing short pastel shorts to one of these records.
What's that next year? What about you?
I kind of said them earlier, actually. Either give Hannibal a scene at the end of the film. I feel like it's just left hanging his storyline. Or have included that attack on Will Graham's house, which he kind of set up, because that would have been a bit of the end of his story as well.
Yeah, I've said my change as well. Just more visual impact on him, you know, that's if he's meant to be this person that can delve into the mind of the most awful minds in the world, like, how does that affect him?
Nice.
Yeah. All right, then. So that is Manhunter, a surprising but very enjoyable movie.
By the way, we didn't ask what the connection between the two films was at the start of this show. Do you know what the connection is? It's Bulldog Briscoe.
Oh, yeah, I know this. Again, I'm having such a good week. Let me say.
She loves this section, Alex.
Let me say. Fuck, I've lost my notes. Shush, don't say a word. What's he called? He's called Dan something. Dan Butler.
Right, yeah.
Yes, Dan Butler is in both films. He is in Manhunter as a police person.
He is a fingerprint analyst.
Whatever. Uh-huh. And he's in Silence of the Lambs as a bug geek, which we'll get to because that's a strict
entomologist.
Bug geek. Can you name me the other actor?
No, but you don't know who Bulldog Briscoe is. Do you know who Bulldog Briscoe is?
Oh, you do, don't you?
I'm sorry, I'm shaking my head. I should have said no.
It's Bulldog from Frasier.
I don't watch Frasier.
Oh, forgot. Okay. Everyone watches bloody Frasier.
It's okay, doesn't matter.
What's it about?
It's about a bulldog called Briscoe.
Sounds great.
Can you name the other actor that appears in both films?
Frankie Faison.
Oh, yeah, that's the right answer.
He's in all of them.
Oh, yeah. But he's so in both.
He's in all the Hannibal Lecter films.
Okay.
Barney.
But he's
the
not,
one person yeah. that Hannibal, apart from Clarice, the one person that Hannibal Lecter likes.
And who was he in Frasier?
He was in The Wire. He was Bunk in The Wire, I think.
Okay, great.
Colleen Atwood, she did the costumes for both Manhunter and Silence of the Lambs.
Nice. Do you know who's in just
Frasier?
Manhunter.
Would that be George Romero?
No, is he in?
He's in it.
Sorry,
Silence of the Lambs, bugger.
No,
I went
that's
early.
Not George Romero, it's Roger Corman. Yeah.
No, George Romero is at the end, plays a cop who walks by when he's in the big cell.
Oh!
Yeah.
Once again, can I just say, how we've gotten to this long, meandering, quite boring section is talking about the connection. So I think when it's really obvious, maybe we don't need to say, or you need to bring your A game to this part.
All right, I got one.
You fucked up Bulldog Briscoe, not me. I would have done that in one sentence.
You went on for ages.
It's important.
You're
the
welcome.
Connection is films with Hannibal Lecter in. Are you happy now?
Chris?
Yep. Shall we talk about the other one?
Yeah,
let's do Silence of the Lambs.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
This week, I was given Silence of the Lambs, which, despite its name, is not a documentary about soundproofing your farm. Of course you knew that. It's the movie in which Anthony Hopkins chews his way through people and scenery after he takes a shine to Jodie Foster's FBI agent. In fact, so much of a shine that when someone upsets her, he makes them swallow their own tongue, immediately redefining the term overprotective.
You spook easily, Starling?
Not yet, sir.
He's past the others. The last cell. I'll be watching.
Oh, Clarice, your problem is you need to get more fun out of life.
So, Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
It was weird watching it again, I will say, because I haven't seen it for a long time. And when I first watched it, it was before it had been parodied the crap out of by everyone.
Oh. Yeah.
And to now watch Anthony Hopkins' performance is a different experience to when you saw it before it became the thing that everyone did.
Is it the most parodied film of the last 30 years? I feel like it might be. It's so sort of bled into the public consciousness that it's weird watching it now.
It is, especially his performance. More than anything else, it's about him, which is a shame because it is a fantastic performance.
So it came out in America on Valentine's Day, 1991. Good date movie?
I think so.
Definitely.
Depends who you're with. I tell you what, it would sort of telegraph that you were quite woke to the male gaze, and that goes a long way, let me tell you.
Yeah, and then you could sort of do funny jokes when you got back to your apartment afterwards.
Like, do you want some wine?
Yeah, do you want some wine?
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
I love that.
I thought he wasn't going to do impressions and bangs.
No, he's allowed to do Buffalo Bill. Do it as much as you want.
You've got to go an octave deeper than you for Buffalo Bill.
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
Oh, that's good. That's now we're cooking, Alex.
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
Just
and it
do that
does
for the
that
next hour.
Every time it's told.
I took a girl on a first date to see Zodiac, and about halfway through, I wish I hadn't done this.
Too long. Mm. So any interest will have died by that.
Just sit in silence for 3 hours. Yeah. And you, with your short shorts on. So interesting. Chilton, Dr. Chilton, his character in Manhunter, quite useful, quite helpful to the police. In this, massive sleazeball. Mm. I love him in this.
Mm. He's good.
Hideous. The bit at the start where he goes, so are you staying in town overnight?
Yeah.
And she goes, no, I've got to go. And he's like, right, that's that then. And loses interest immediately.
Yeah. Chilton has to be annoying and creepy enough that at the end of the film, you actually want him to be murdered.
Yeah.
And they pull that off, which is impressive, I think.
I'm having an old friend for dinner.
I did
well,
it.
We're really jumping ahead here, aren't we?
Well, that's Silence of the Lambs then. So I have a really basic problem with this. Now, I love the production design on Hannibal Lecter's cell.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the cell that he's in Manhunter is the kind of cell that you should put such an intelligent serial killer in. A white room where nothing is hidden.
Yeah.
This is like a dungeon.
But it is literally a dungeon. I mean, there's been a lot said about it's a Rococo nightmare. She descends from a correctional facility when Clarice first gets to meet Dr. Chilton, and they go down into the bowels of something, and then they are in a dungeon and he's caged. Whereas Brian Cox's Hannibal Lecter, it's a clinical environment, which makes a lot more sense and is much more realistic.
Mm.
But it's a stylistic choice.
It's the Hammer horror version for me. It's the gothic Hammer horror, which is fun.
Yeah, it is. But you could dislodge... I mean, his Hannibal Lecter, he could dislodge one of those bricks, shave it off into a point. He's got a weapon in seconds. Look, from experience of being in correctional facilities, like that is a total like no-no. You don't give a man like that bricks.
Talk, what are you talking about?
I 100% agree.
What's he shaving the bricks down with?
His the laser focus of his intelligence, I think. He just looks at them.
No, did you not? Oh, you might have seen a different version. He's got laser eyes in the version
I saw. Yeah, in the director's cut that I saw with my free book, Telekinesis by Hannibal Lecter, that's what he did.
Yeah, yeah, just... with his eyes.
Like Thingy from X-Men, you know.
Yes, Cyclops, yeah. Did you not see the laser eyes version? Oh, never mind.
I will sell it to you for £5.
So we have jumped straight to Hannibal Lecter's cell, have we?
Well, it's a really early scene. And also, I love it because as a cold sore sufferer, it's nice to see Jodie Foster suffering from a cold sore in that scene.
Has she got a cold sore?
She's got a cold sore on her lip,
Has she? Yeah. Well, that does make me love her more.
Right. So because I think some other actors might maybe go, I cannot go on camera today. But she was like,
she's like, I'm going to win an Oscar.
Give me some Zvirex and I'm out.
I'll see you there. Sorry, Chris. Do you want to know, in the books, which Chris will attest to, Hannibal Lecter is described as a sociopath. Dr. Chilton describes him as a psychopath. Would you like to know the difference between the two?
The spelling.
There's the spelling, right. Correct. So do you want to know? You probably already know.
I feel like there's still questions over what the difference between the two are.
Sure, it's an evolving field,
exactly,
for sure.
Yeah. But if you want to go on record right now...
What does it say in Head Games?
It says, I'll read it word for word. No. So psychopathy is just, it can be thought of as a more severe form of sociopathy. So therefore, all psychopaths are sociopaths, but not all sociopaths are necessarily psychopaths. So traits of a sociopath who can then sort of become a psychopath would be lack of guilt, lack of empathy, narcissism, lack of fear, an excellent ability to lie, etc.
You must have read the psychopath test.
I have, yeah. I did enjoy that. Although, I suppose... The main takeaway that I took and that everyone I knew took from it was like, my boss is a psychopath.
All politicians are psychopaths. Yeah. Anyone in the public eye is a psychopath.
All men in a position of power, all bosses are psychopaths.
Anyone on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Did you find this scary at any point? Because some people talk of this as a horror movie. I don't really buy that. I don't think this is a horror movie. I know they do it because then they can go, well, it's a horror movie that won Best Picture, but it didn't.
Well, I mean, it did,
but it's not a horror movie.
Watching it this time made me feel like I wish I could watch it for the first time again. Mm. Oh, you know, I was 13 years old when I first watched it. I'm sure that a lot of this stuff scared me. I'm sure I was surprised by lots of it, but I see it all coming so early now that it doesn't really...
A lot of the scenes that people sort of talk about as being like horror scenes, I just didn't find scary. Like the bit where Jodie Foster goes into that storage.
Oh, the storage unit.
Yeah. Like the best episode of Storage Wars ever. You know, like a hoarder's wet dream. Yeah. And then she finds the head in the jar.
Yeah.
And that sort of reveal is played like as a jump scare, I think. But I was like, meh, head in a jar.
It felt a bit like the jump scare head from Jaws trying to recreate that. Because also, I guess you've got to go back to the fact that this was the first of its kind. I mean, Manhunter came before, but this was the first huge mainstream Hollywood film about a serial killer, like a blockbuster about a serial killer. We've had so many since then. I think at the time it was different to what it is now, where it's been copycatted so much, even by a film called Copycat, that it's...
Oh, that's a Sigourney Weaver movie that I've seen. That's
I've seen
great.
That, yeah.
I'll tell you something. Last time I saw this was about 5 years ago, and Jameson, the whiskey, put on a screening of it. And so I went along and ended up drinking a lot of Jameson in the bar and ending up with the worst seat in the house to the side. It wasn't in a proper cinema, to the side of the screen where half of me could see the audience and half of me could see the film. And it was a lot of young people who'd never seen the film before. This was their first time. And half the time I kept looking at the audience rather than the screen because I knew what scenes were coming. People were properly screaming. Like, it had this incredible effect on an audience. And I think we forget that because we've seen it a lot.
Was it not just because they were so pissed on Jameson, though?
The scene that really does scare me still, and I guess it's kind of a weird scene to pick as one of the scariest, it's when he needs help with the sofa into the armchair, into the van, and he sort of tricks her to back in first. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't really trick her. He goes, "You back in first." And she goes, "All right, it won't end well."
No.
But that scene...
Yeah, because there's so much in that scene, because she knows every woman, every person knows... And like that's how Ted Bundy got a lot of people, is, will you help me? And there are so many power structures in play in that one moment. Like, you don't want to be a bitch. Mm. You don't want to say no. You don't want to be rude. And then when he manoeuvres her so that she knows she's going to end up in the back of the van, she doesn't want to break social convention and be like, actually, I'm terrified. I'm going to run away. So she just basically gets in.
Yeah. And then when he finds the label and finds out she's a size 14, he's like, good.
Ugh.
Yeah. Because he's not saying good about the fact that it's made in Indonesia or 60% polyester.
Cheap.
But it's also the way Demi builds and builds and builds scenes, like certainly Lecter's escape, and also when you realise Clarice is at Buffalo Bill's house. The way the tension ratchets up through them, that was, you could feel that in the audience when I was watching. Because that's the first time I'd seen it with an audience as well, because I was too young to see it in the cinema at the time. And you're on the edge of your seat for so long during Hannibal Lecter's escape, waiting for him to do what he's going to do. And then when he does it, it's horrific.
Mm.
You mean when he attacks the officers?
Yes.
Yeah, that's...
Drawn out as well, so you're just sort of...
Again, this is like little baby things that really annoy me. It's like, this is, by all accounts, one of the most dangerous men on the planet.
Yeah.
And you put him in an art gallery in a birdcage.
Yeah.
It doesn't really...
Did you see the little traffic fence that it's got?
Like, yes.
Outside, like, he's going to go, oh, no, well, I can't then, obviously. I can't escape.
Damn the little fence! I nearly got out!
You've built a huge birdcage for him, but you haven't put a camera in there to watch him.
Yep. Or given the police officers a gun.
Or put any more than two police officers who don't look in the best shape either to watch him.
Yeah.
Right, can we go back to the beginning, though?
Chris, the beginning.
So in another dimension, this film would have been directed by Gene Hackman and starred Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer, with Hackman playing Crawford.
Hello, Clarice.
So there was...
Are the lambs still screaming? Clarice... Are the lambs still screaming?
That's so shit. That's so funny.
That's very good.
Absolutely.
I ate his liver with a nice Chianti.
Did you read the article Deadline did on the 25th anniversary of the film? Because there were so many good bits of information there. Jonathan Demme said, "We sent the script to Sean Connery first. Word came back shortly that he thought it was disgusting and wouldn't dream of playing that part." Don't mince your words, Sean.
Yeah, but wasn't it the case with Michelle Pfeiffer? Demme wanted Michelle Pfeiffer to play Clarice Starling. She read the script and went, "Hur!" Then he wanted Meg Ryan to do it. She read the script and went, "Hur!" And then eventually, after he couldn't get Laura Dern because the studio wouldn't allow her to play it because she wasn't bankable enough, he settled on Jodie Foster.
Who was fighting for it.
Yes.
She tried to buy the book herself, but the rights had already been bought by Gene Hackman. And it was Gene Hackman's daughter who read the book and said, "Dad, don't make this." And Jonathan Demme said, "God bless Gene Hackman's daughter." But yeah, and I was just wanted to talk about the opening of the film and the feminist stuff going on here.
Yeah, so first of all...
Which I feel I should talk about.
Speak from the heart and from your experience of what it's like to navigate the male gaze in your everyday life. Anyway, yeah, we meet Clarice, and this is it's quite anti-feminist, but I was like, oh, I noticed she was running in makeup and earrings, which is a weird choice. And she,
see, I didn't notice that because I'm not a sexist pig.
Yeah, there's a lot of framing of Clarice, especially at the FBI Academy, where she's surrounded by men and she's the only woman and she seems quite small, like physically small in comparison to them, to show that she's quite alone in her work. Mm. And Catherine Martin doesn't die, which is very unusual. She survives.
She's the lamb that Clarice can finally save.
I don't know that it's a good move if you're a serial killer, though, to kidnap a senator's daughter.
It's a mistake.
I mean, they have more resources than most people. So I thought that was a bad move.
He's just looking for someone who's a size 14. I feel like that's all the research he's doing, isn't it? And even then, he's not. He's waiting until she's in there to check if it's size 14.
Yeah, you don't need that moment. You can look at her, and surely you can. And also, I thought he's.
I don't know. I don't judge like that.
Oh, that's true. Oh, yeah. Shit!
How are you losing this? I'm shocked.
Fucking hell.
I like the bit where Clarice understands that as a girl, you would probably hide some naughty photographs in the secret compartment of your music box.
Yeah.
What I don't like is that she then leaves those photographs on top of it for the father of a dead girl to find and go, what?
She also runs downstairs, uses his phone and says at the top of her voice, he's making a costume out of women. Have some sensitivity.
Sorry, what's that? He's doing what?
With my child.
The police didn't say anything about a costume out of skin. Oh, no, something else. Different case.
It's very insensitive. The scariest scene is when Buffalo Bill is doing, when he's getting dressed to that song and he's putting his makeup on. Mm. And then the famous, I don't even know how to describe it. I'm not going to say it.
He chucks away his meat and two veg. How's that?
That's very manly. Nice. Yeah.
Have you ever tried that?
Of course. What man hasn't at some point? Have you? Are you about to show me a phone? Chris, why have you got your phone?
I'm trying to find the name of something out, not my penis.
Does it have a name? He's a much less sympathetic killer than Dollar Hyde.
No, I don't think that's true.
Really? I think 100% it is.
But he does feel, when Catherine Martin is pleading with him and he's saying it rubs the lotion on its skin.
It rubs the lotion on.
It gets the holes. it's having an effect on him. That he feels bad. He nearly starts to cry because she is in such distress.
But at the same time,
he starts mocking her when she's crying.
That's a defence mechanism.
No, I don't think it's a defence mechanism. I think it's him trying to mimic her because for when he's got the woman suit on.
Oh,
it's him practising. Yeah. I guess, so this was quite a controversial film at the time within the LGBTQ community. The feeling was, oh, great, you're connecting someone who's transsexual with being a serial killer. Oh, great, why are the only gay characters in movies murderers?
Yeah.
And it came, a couple of years later, you had Basic Instinct where there were similar complaints. Now, watching and reading around this film now, they seemed very confused at the time with the message they were trying to get across with Buffalo Bill, to the point that Demi saying one thing, the screenwriter Ted Talley saying something else, and the actor Ted Levine is saying something completely different. So I think they weren't on the same page, and that's why it's just slightly messy. What his problem is, and
what did Demi say when he was approached with this controversy? He said that the character isn't gay. He just hates himself so much. That's why he wants to transform into a woman, because it will be the complete opposite to who he is right now.
And Lecter says Billy is not a real transsexual. He thinks he is. So he was turned down, wasn't he? They say he was turned down for gender reassignment because of his, his mental state. Mm. And so, they're saying it's more about him hating his own identity, as you say. But I don't know, Ted Levine says that he's not gay because if he was gay, he'd be killing men and boys. And I don't know if that holds water. That doesn't mean that.
I mean, the facts are a trans person is much more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator of a crime.
And I think, doesn't Clarice Starling say something about, not that exact quote, but she said they're less likely to be violent.
It's a bit, I don't think you'd include it, it's a bit ropey now, but she says transsexuals are very passive people.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's them making an effort almost. As you say, it's the 1991 version, maybe, of trying to course correct it.
So have you ever actually stuck your penis between your thighs? You never answered that question. You asked me it and I answered
think
very
I have. What? I've seen a couple of friends do it.
Hell of a night, eh?
At uni. I won't name them.
Do you feel like you...
I mean, how did you take what was already a weird question and somehow make it weirder?
That's a good point.
I don't know.
I just think it's noticeable that the next film Demi made was Philadelphia.
Yeah.
So it felt like I think he did feel a bit of guilt that maybe they got that aspect of it wrong. And he certainly said he'd wish they'd talked more about Buffalo Bill's childhood, which is much more in the book.
What I would change is you need more of Buffalo Bill in this. Yeah. I think there's a startling, especially rewatching it, a startling lack of time spent with this guy.
Well, I guess it's a narrative decision they make to suddenly the film becomes a Hannibal Lecter film for 20 minutes, two-thirds of the way through.
Yep.
And it's maybe the best sequence in the movie. But you forget about Clarice and Buffalo Bill. So it's strange. It's weird.
But it's still such a cool escape.
No, agreed.
And the bit where he sits up in the ambulance with a face on his own face. I'm like, oh, double face.
Again, though, because I think it's so much more effective when you don't know what's coming. And I'm waiting for it now. But seeing with an audience that didn't know or was putting the pieces together at the same time it was happening on screen is really exciting.
So I watched it with someone who hadn't seen it before and I was like, go away,
double
face!
Don't you? But you were doing what I was doing then probably. You're sort of looking at them a little bit as well as looking at the film.
Yeah, but I probably didn't do it as creepily as you did. People are in a cinema in the dark and you're just staring
in between.
And you can always feel it when someone's staring at you as well, can't you? And then there's just this little... white face in the darkness.
The pissed Jameson's drunk guy in the corner looking.
Sloshing whiskey.
Maybe
everywhere.
That's why they were screaming so much. Maybe that's
why they put you on the end seat. they saw you.
That was amazing. They had this actor who really, it was like an immersive experience. He sat in the corner and creeped the fuck out of everyone.
It would have been even weird.
I think he was like real method. He was definitely drinking for real. I was reading Ted Talley, the screenwriter. Writers are the best people to ever interview because they're the honest ones. Like, they don't mince their words. And he was saying how he really wanted to do Hannibal. And they read the book, him and Jonathan Demme. And they both went, well, this is awful. We can't do it. We can't make this. And he says, it's such a shame because it would have been a Spielberg-level payday for them both.
Yeah.
I think I couldn't quite work out. He didn't sort of elaborate on why he hated that book so much, but I'm guessing it's because it takes, you know, this hideous monster and turns him into the hero.
Like a bit of a sexy man.
Mm, yeah. Sort of sympathetic character.
And
you want Hannibal to beat Gary Oldman at the end.
Yeah, and you want him to get together with Clarice.
Yeah, that's completely off. I'm sure you know about John Douglas.
No.
Jack Crawford is based on John Douglas, who runs the FBI's behavioural science unit.
Oh, I do know this.
I thought you did.
Yeah,
I knew she would.
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Tell the story.
And so he helped out with the making of the film. Obviously, the FBI liked the idea of making this movie because they wanted to recruit more women and they thought this would be a good tool. And so him and Scott Glenn...
That's weird. Do you like getting sperm in your hair? Work for us.
So John Douglas and Scott Glenn became really good friends while they were making it.
Okay.
And John Douglas wrote the book Mindhunter.
Oh, okay.
And so that's what Mindhunter's entirely based on his career.
Yeah. The reason I know that's about the FBI Behavioural Science Unit is because it's a relatively new thing. Mm. So they didn't have it. And there's a part, it's these two things coalesce. So when Hannibal Lecter is given the case notes and then Clarice gets them back and her friend notice that he's written a message on the map. Did you see how pronounced the state lines were on the map? Like, they're marked out in red and there's quite a lot of bleed between the states. And I wondered if that was because in the US, they did have a real problem up until the behavioral science unit and the sort of talking between states with serial killers just moving over state lines.
Mm.
So, and it's so easy to do.
Yeah.
But the minute you move over, you're dealing with a different police department and they weren't talking to each other. So that's why it was really difficult to catch Ted Bundy because he just moved south and everyone was like, well, there's no problem.
That's exactly what... And the Golden State Killer was the same.
Yeah.
That's exactly what Mindhunter's about, though, is how hard it was to convince people that it was actually worth
doing
behavioural science.
Yeah. Thanks. And the Golden State Killer was a police officer. What the fuck?
He was a police officer who at one time was going round communities giving them advice on how to stay protected from the Golden State Killer.
He held a conference and everyone's, because he was breaking into people's houses, and his MO at the time would be to rape the woman in front of the man and then kill them both. Brilliant.
Mm.
So he stood up And a man in the audience couldn't deal with this and was like, there's no way that would happen in my house. Like, I would step up, I would protect my family. And everyone's listening, it's like, well, you know, da da da. And he was next.
Yeah. No!
Yes, yeah, yeah. Swear to God.
Oh my God.
And that's how they knew that the killer was in that room. So they spent years looking over every single person that was in that meeting. And
this was like 40 years ago, and he's only just been caught.
Yeah.
So the killer, do you think he'd already picked that guy, or did he get pissed off the guy
that day? Yeah, it was an ego thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Awful, isn't it? Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, sorry. I had a fact about Buffalo Bill, but I've just read it, and it's actually quite boring.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, I'm glad we're self-editing.
Oh, I'll tell you what, it'll come up later in the quiz.
Oh, great.
Oh, hello.
Well, let's crack on then. The only thing that annoys me is Dr. Chilton.
Yeah,
at the end, mm-hmm. looks like he's going on holiday somewhere. He's like, out and about.
Yeah, but hasn't he gone as like sort of far away as he can? Isn't he like setting up an orphanage or something?
No, he's going into hiding. The people that meet him, and you can hear a brief bit of dialogue.
It's
about his security.
Yeah.
He's on the run.
Fine,
because he looks fucking terrified.
Because my issue was basically like, if I was Dr. Chilton and I knew Hannibal Lecter was free, I'd be in a fucking bunker with all the guns ever. And he's just sort of wandering around. But if he was actually going into hiding, that makes more sense. Yeah.
So, but in terms of that ending, there was that Deadline article talks about the other ending that was in Tally's script. And this is a phone call between Clarice and Hannibal, but you're not quite sure where he is. And it turns out he's in an office with cutting segments of orange with a knife. And then the camera, once he's hung up, the camera pans back and Chilton is tied to a chair. And he walks over to him and says, with the knife, says, shall we begin?
Oh.
But Demi thought that was, in his words, too icky. And it would be more cinematic to have Hannibal out and about in the world.
Yeah, true.
And although Thomas Harris said he will never watch any of the Hannibal Lecter films, and that's because John le Carré said that when he saw Alec Guinness in one of his adaptations, he then couldn't stop thinking about Alec Guinness rather than what the character he'd come up with. Jonathan Demme did approach him and say, look, can we change this ending? And he said, yes. He said, it would be more believable that Lecter would be in Zurich looking at watches than be in the tropics. Mm. That's my Lecter, but you can do that. But my one note to you is, have it be a hot day and everyone's sweating, but Hannibal Lecter does not sweat.
Cool.
And so that's what they did.
Cool. I mean, I did feel hot watching him because everyone else is in like safari suits and he's like in a trilby. I'm like, and you are going to be hot under that.
Yeah, and he has, we didn't really talk about Hopkins himself. It's quite funny when I was reading places him that talking about all the research he did and then watching interviews with him, and he says in the, that's all bollocks. He said, I didn't do any research. I just showed up and read the lines. Like, I got who the guy was. Yeah, I just learned the lines and showed up. And what a transformation for his career, though, because he really was a jobbing actor who'd, I think, that Bridge Too Far, Magic, and really the biggest film he'd done was Elephant
Free
Man.
Jack. Oh.
Well, he went from this on to Free Jack.
Yeah, all right, cool. Shall we move on to the bit?
Chris, what's your best scene?
I think it is that ending when he says, I have no plans on calling you. The world's more interesting with you in it. And then having an old friend for dinner. I think it's such a brilliant way to end the film. And I think it's partly what made Hannibal Lecter, because we walk out of that film quite liking him again. And I think that's why we ended up with these other films.
Yeah. My best scene is the first meeting of Clarice and Lecter. Then he's just sort of standing there motionless in his cell. And you're like, he's been standing there for maybe hours, or has he just got up and we happened to catch him when he was standing there?
My best scene is the when she's talking about the lamb, basically. Like, she just, it's just so believable. Like, when she's talking about the lamb was so heavy. It's like, oh my God.
Yeah, that is good.
Your most valuable character, Chris?
Well, I'm not going to say Lecter.
Why are you not saying Lecter?
It's too obvious. Okay. It's got to be Miggs.
Oh, shut up.
Okay, so Miggs is your MVC.
Or Precious.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. My MVC, Vicky, is the moths. All the moths. Death's head moths.
Fucking hell. They're so big. Mm-hmm. There's some, and there's a bit where they're on his face. My most valuable character is Buffalo Bill, because he's really hard to circle in on how you feel about him. He's really difficult to shake off. I did feel sorry for him, but obviously he's a monster, and it's just done very well. And one change you would make, Alex?
More of Buffalo Bill, please. I thought Ted Levine's performance was great. I thought the character was fascinating. I just wish I'd known more about him and we'd had more of him on screen.
Yeah, same. I wish they'd figured out exactly where he was coming from, so this film
maybe cause less offence to people, because I think that's a sad thing.
My one change, have some of this, is maybe a few more layers of usefulness to Chilton. So maybe he could teach Clarice something. Even though he's arrogant, even though he's an arsehole, just one thing that was useful in her approach to his patient. And you can have a tiny moment which where the power is just slightly shifted.
Yeah, because he gives her a sort of series of rules and quite graphically explains why she should follow them at the start. He's like, his pulse didn't go above 85 even when he bit off her tongue. Have a look at that photo. Sick, isn't it? That's the guy you're meeting.
Yeah.
And then the second time she meets him, she's sitting on a coat right up against the glass like she's at a festival. Like she's at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And you're like, did you not remember the rules?
She looks at it, he sent her a towel because her hair's wet. She's like, oh my God, thank you so much. Now, do you want a quiz?
Yes.
Are you ready? I'll be quick.
Wait, is it a good quiz?
Yes.
They're never good. No. If they're good, it would be disappointing.
Okay. Well, let's find out. According to William Seabrook, a reporter at the New York Times in 1931, which meat does human most closely taste like?
Chicken.
Is it chicken?
It's veal.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh. There was a patient, according to...
Well, no, don't eat veal.
No, I don't. Well, I've had it. But I was in Italy, so I think that's fine.
Yeah, it's like the state lines thing. You just got to keep moving from country to country. That way you can keep eating veal. As long as you don't stay in one country and eat more veal, it's fine.
Oh, dear. Oh, very good. What do you think is the average IQ of a serial killer?
130.
You're saying 130. What are you saying?
I'm going to say 95.
Oh, the answer is 89.
What?
Yeah, the fallacy is that they're all geniuses because of films like this, and they aren't all geniuses.
However,
it's not just that. It's because to get away with it for the length of time that some of them do to actually become a serial killer, surely that requires a certain level of intelligence.
I don't think so. I think there's that, but there's also a lot of people don't care about murdered women. Whoa, I said it. It's a combination of the two things, and especially if they're sex workers, you might get a few months in which to complete your dastardy plans.
Right.
What did Buffalo Bill call his rifle?
Oh,
you'll never get this.
Are you talking about the real Buffalo?
The real. Oh, yeah. Sorry, I should explain. The real Buffalo Bill was a buffalo hunter.
Never ever go into a quiz making as a career, because it's just.
Why would I have to?
Really crucial information is missing from every question.
Because I'm under pressure.
Was it called Carl
Hornblower?
No, that's a good answer. Hornblower is a sensible answer. No, it wasn't called Carl.
Simon.
No.
Brian.
Right, stop. It was called...
Gunny, Mr. Gun.
No.
Can it be Gunny?
No, it's not Gunny. He called his rifle Lucrezia Borgia after the ruthless Italian noblewoman from like 14-something. So there you go. That's my quiz.
I won.
Have you been actually tallying a score?
I just got the closest to the IQ.
Yeah.
So that means I won.
I think that was a good
quiz. I got
quiz.
Gunny. All right then, so it's time for the verdict.
No, it's not, because before we do the verdict...
I've got a quiz as well.
No, we've got the other question we were going to ask, so...
Have I missed an email again?
No, it's all right, you're going to be able to answer it. Alex, is Anthony Hopkins your favourite Hannibal Lecter, or do you prefer Cox?
Very good.
Really?
Yeah, sorry.
Right. I prefer Cox.
Do you?
No, but I wanted to say that.
Okay. You're going Anthony Hopkins?
Yeah.
Vicky, prefer Cox?
This is... So, you know I do. This is very hard. Brian Cox himself in Head Games said that.
Head Games. Chris, have you read Head Games?
Spit it out. It's my favourite book.
He said the difference between them is Brian Cox is insane, Anthony Hopkins is mad. And I prefer an insane portrayal. So I would say Cox.
Nice.
You're welcome.
I'm going Hopkins, so... Oh, yeah, and I did a poll. I did a poll on Twitter.
Oh, okay.
Did you?
201 people voted. I added in the other two Hannibal Lecters, Gaspard Ulliel, who did Hannibal Rising, and Mads Mikkelsen from the TV.
Did Gaspar get any?
He got 1%. Okay. Bless him. Brian Cox got only 11%.
Okay.
Ooh. I bet Mass, isn't it? It's pronounced Mass Mikkelsen.
Is it?
Hmm. It's not actually Mads, because that would be a crazy name.
Well, I'm just going to say Mikkelsen got...
Mass Mikkelsen.
Mikkelsen got 36% and Anthony Hopkins got 52%.
Oh,
so
okay.
This room agrees with
me.
The majority.
And you?
Yeah.
Right, it's time for the verdict.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Okay. Yeah. Chris, which film featuring Hannibal Lecter do you think should win this week?
Well, I like Manhunter, but I think Silence has so many moments that transcend film. And also, we didn't even talk about the fact it won the big five Oscars.
Is it?
Only the third film in history to do that.
Do you know the other two?
Yes, I do! Yes!
Go on.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Correct!
And that other old one that I've just forgotten the name of. In the thingy.
It happened one night.
Oh, fuck that!
Yes. That one.
It's an old film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, especially the stuff with Clarice and Hopkins. It's like two heavyweight boxers sparring. I love it. It's not just the best film this week. It's not just the best film we've covered. It's one of the best films of all time. Manhunter. No, Silence of the Lambs.
I'm going to hear what you've said, and I'm going to partially agree with you. And I am going to prefix this with the fact that I've seen Silence of the Lambs previously, and I couldn't quite shake the fact that it felt like I've seen it so many times now because it has been mimicked so much. And Manhunter was such a curveball for me, and I didn't really expect to be that overpowered by the sense of dread and the atmosphere throughout it. And even though I've slagged off some of the music choices, they do give it quite an alien quality, which makes it a far weirder and troubling watch for me than Silence of the Lambs, which I think is a much more mainstream and accessible film. So not just to be contrary, but based on the viewings this week, I'm saying Manhunter.
See, that's the thing. I'm
the hipster's choice. That was me in 1992 going around school saying, well, actually, Brian Cox is the best Hannibal Lecter. You're all wrong.
I picked Hopkins for my Hannibal. I'm just saying I like that. That movie, Manhunter, had a more pronounced effect on me.
Cool.
So this is difficult because I thought this would be a slam dunk for me for Silence of the Lambs, like obviously. And then I watched Manhunter and I thought it was incredible. And it was really, really torn. Like the violence is implied. I like that. The white cell, the clinical aspect of it versus a gory sort of shock fest, I really, really like. And so I'm really stuck. So then I'm down to Will Graham versus Clarice Starling. So then I'm down to a woman versus a man. And then it's something we call positive discrimination. And so for that reason, I have to pick Silence of the Lambs because of the way it deals with the male gaze. How can I not? So it has to be Silence of the Lambs. But I'm very torn.
I think that's great. I think if actually Manhunter had won this week, we'd have a lot of questions to answer.
Yeah. Well, also, I think I don't know if I could do the podcast anymore after last week. Fucking Dread and Manhunter. Wankers. Hipster wankers.
All right, great stuff. Silence of the Lambs is this week's winner.
Well, Clarice, have the lambs stopped screaming?
So, on to next week. Whose choices is it?
Mine.
So, Chris, what have you got for us next week?
So, as we're nearing the festive season, Vicky, I would like you to do 1984's Gremlins.
Thank you very much.
And Alex Zane, I am giving you a film in a completely different genre, and you are getting 1990's Gremlins 2.
Very good.
Okay. I am actually happy with that choice very much. So, thank you, Chris. Thank you. Are you happy? You seem like...
I'm just trying to make sure I got the right year because I never checked them. I'm sure it's 1990, isn't it?
Yeah, let's go with that for the moment.
Who cares?
No one cares.
Don't know why I said the years.
So that is it for next week. If you want to do your homework, we are doing Gremlins versus Gremlins 2, the new batch. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch on email, it's show@clashpod.com or on Twitter @clashpod. And please do rate and review us and subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. It really makes a difference and we'd appreciate it greatly. Thanks very much. Back in a week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.